You're listening to 99.1 WQRT LP, and welcome to Radio Free Book Club for March 2023. I'm Ken Honeywell. I'm a writer and reader from Indianapolis. Today we're going to talk about a trippy fantasy set in a post-Katrina New Orleans, a sort of shadow New Orleans filled with ghosts, haints, zombies, huge talking rodents, sky trolleys, runaway songs. We can stop right there because we're going to get into all of that and more, I'm sure. This is a first novel by Alex Jennings. It's called The Ballad of Perilous Graves, and I am really looking forward to discussing this one. Fortunately, we also have some other folks in the studio who are great discussers, and I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves. Let's start with Christine. Hi, Christine.
Hey, Ken. Hi, everyone. My name is Christine Hudson. Happy to be back for another episode of Radio Free Book Club. I'm an Indianapolis native, love writing, love reading, so super excited to talk about this book today. I don't usually read fantasy or magic. So I had a lot of fun with this, and I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. Alex, hello.
Hey, Ken, and everyone in Radio Land. My name is Alex Mattingly. I'm also a reader and writer initially from Indianapolis, although we just moved out to pursue the agrarian lifestyle out in Fillmore, Indiana. So we're giving that a try right now and killing far too many mice for my taste. But
Yeah, that's one of the benefits, I know. Yeah, thanks, Alex. Well, hello, Maurice.
Hello, Ken. Back again.
Yeah.
Maurice Broaddus, also reader and writer. I call Indianapolis home, and so I set most of my stories here.
Yeah, awesome. What's your latest book called, and where can we get it?
I have two. One is a middle grade detective novel called Unfadable. And the other one is a science fiction, the first of my science fiction trilogy called Sweep of Stars, available everywhere you like to buy books.
All right. Thanks. Thank you, Maurice. Glad you're all here. And just before we get started, please know this is not a book review show. It's a book club. We're going to be talking about all sorts of characters and plot points, and there will be as many spoilers as there are Peabody's in NOLA. And if you have no idea what I just said and you would like to read The Ballad of Perilous Graves to find out, you might just want to come back and listen after you've read it, and we hope you will. You can find this and all the podcasts of Radio Free Book Club at Mixcloud and Spotify and Apple and just about anywhere you stream podcasts. So, yeah, let's get started. Maurice, you brought us this book. How'd you come by it? And maybe you could give us a little bit of a setup.
Sure. I came by it because I was actually at a writer's conference in New Orleans. And actually, Alex was there, but it wasn't because of that I came across the book. It's because there was another writer, her name is Cherie Renee Thomas, and she was going on about people's books because she was, and you know, whenever Cherie talks, everybody just, let's be quiet, Cherie is talking. and she talked about Sweep of Stars, my book, and then she talked about Alex's book, and like, these two books, and these two authors put their foot in this book. And I'm just like, man, I know I put my foot in my book. Let me see what this brother's book is like. And so that's how I came across this book.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, and it was according to your end of the year list, this was your favorite book of last year.
It was. It's a wild ride. But I was trying to think of how we would try to summarize it, and so I decided to cheat.
Okay.
And it's not a review show, but yet here it is, the review from Publisher Weekly.
Yeah, that's good.
This is just a quick paragraph from it. Music, magic, and music here, one in the same, bring to life a vibrant alternate New Orleans in Jennings' stunning urban fantasy debut. When Perilous Perry Graves enters the city's famed undead, encounters the city's famed undead pianist, Dr. Professor, he knows something's wrong. Nine of the powerful songs that keep NOLA humming have been stolen, and the city breaks down. Its sky's trolley stop running. The magic that maintains the city fizzles. From there, the jazzy tale alternates timelines, perspectives between Perry, his younger sister Brandy, his friend Peaches, Casey Ravel, a trans man who moved back to town years after fleeing Hurricane Katrina. As Casey reconnects with his cousin Jalen, now a celebrated artist, they look back on their teenage graffiti and the uncanny ways their paintings have changed. And after Perry and Brandy's grandfather goes missing, it appears his disappearance may be linked to this music thief.
Well, Maurice,
I'm here for all of this.
Right. I mean, thank goodness someone wrote that.
Right.
Because, oh my goodness, and that just barely scratches the surface, really.
Right.
This is a wild novel. There is so much going on here. There's so much plot. I mean, it just goes on and on. It's so dense with plot. Let's talk, before we talk about the novel, let's just, because of the subject matter, let's talk a little bit about New Orleans. Anyone here familiar with New Orleans, spent time in New Orleans, interested in New Orleans jazz? Anybody?
Well, I've been to New Orleans, I think, 3 times, I think, over the years. New Orleans is actually one of my favorite cities to go to. I came up as a horror writer, so, you know, going to New Orleans, that's like Mecca for us. You know, we go and just the sheer level of history and hoodoo and all these things and the folklore that goes into the city, you know, it's just it's a natural magnet for us. And then plus, I love food.
Sure.
And man, New Orleans and food. I mean, like I said, we're just there back in, I think, November. And we'd like hop into the Uber and like, hey, we're gonna go to this place to go eat, and we're like, I can't take you there. I'll take you to this other place. This is where you actually want to go.
Oh, interesting.
To go eat.
Yeah.
And so I mean, they take their food seriously, and they are not going to let something something bad happen to a tourist. Like, you want to go eat here, and I will always listen.
Yeah, yeah. Alex or Christine, any New Orleans stories?
No, I've never been.
I've been once. We went on like a family vacation, like pre-Katrina. So this must have been like 2003, 2002. So I was pretty young, but I remember thinking this city feels different and like alive. And all I wanted to do was eat beignets and like listen to music. And I have a very specific memory of walking past the levees. And my dad was like, these are the levees that are holding the water out of the city. And I thought he was kidding.
Yeah.
And he was not kidding.
Yeah.
So I have not been back post Katrina, but, yeah, really fascinating city for just, I think we were doing like a southern tour, more or less. So we were only in New Orleans for maybe 2 days. But yeah, lots of memories, lots of fun, lots of good food, lots of good people too. Like Midwest charm, but with like soul and feeling.
Right.
Not just like the empty, like, how are you doing? It also felt like, and I have no scientific basis for this, but it feels like the kind of city where music is always playing, even if it's not. Yeah. So I liked it. I need to go back as an adult and sort of re-experience it.
Yeah, I kind of do too. I was only there one time in the 80s. I was there on business. This is a story I don't have time to tell, but I was working for the ad agency that was working for Ringling Brothers, and they owned the rights to the story of Louis Armstrong, and they were producing a musical of Louis Armstrong's life called Satchmo, an American musical legend. And I was there to write TV commercials for the show that they were debuting in Louis Armstrong Park. And I had a miserable time. Every attempt to get good food was like, they were out of everything but eggs. And it was terrible, terrible experience.
We should have done this review from like the French Quarter.
Yeah. But I do have to say.
What is our travel budget?
Right. Yeah, let's pause.
We'll have to ask the radio station for a little bit of money for that. Yeah, exactly. The only other thing I would say is, and I do like New Orleans jazz. I wasn't that familiar with it until a few years ago. I started to listen to it a little bit more. But just interestingly, the other day, because of this book, I was walking down the street listening to Dr. John, and I didn't know that it was Fat Tuesday.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
So, yeah, that was just a little irony.
Yeah, the timing for this was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really was. So so let's talk about the book. What were your impressions? Christine, you want to start? Was it hard to get into?
Yes, it was. I feel like this book needs a prerequisite course, like white paper or novella or something. Because just like, especially for me, I mentioned I don't usually read a lot of fantasy or like magical realism. So for me, it was like, extra hard to get into because it's not typically a genre that I gravitate towards. So I actually like false started. Like I started the book and then I was like, whoa. And I made it like maybe 54 pages. And I was like, I got to hit the pause button and reorient myself. So then I had to sort of read a review like you read, Maurice, just to sort of like get me in the right dimension, like literally like reorient my brain. Then once I restarted, I liked it a lot. So yeah, hard to get into. I think it was also hard to stay into. Like each time I put it down, it was like closing a chapter of like my brain and like a function of my brain. And each time I picked it back up, I had to like be in the right headspace or re-enter the right headspace to read it, which is not usually an issue I have with reading. Usually I can just, you know, pick it up and read a bit here and there, read the whole thing. But this book was like, it is hard to get into the right headspace and hard to get into. And even once I was into it, I had to sort of re-get into it.
Yeah. What do you think, Alex?
I had almost the mirror image of Christine's experience, I think, where I started and I just, like, I kind of love being dropped into a book this way. It reminded me a little bit of the first time I read Dune, and I'm like, I have no idea what's going on in this book. They're throwing out terms. There are characters. This world is so fully imagined, and they're not going to spoon feed anything to you. You've got books like Chronicles of Narnia, where they're new to the world, and so everybody's explaining everything. And then you have books like this where it's like, you got to catch up. And I enjoy that experience. Like for me, that's more immersive in some ways than kind of being led into the world. But the flip side of that is that I did get to a point, and I'm sure we'll talk about this later, where the character Casey meets his kind of doppelganger in this mirror image of NOLA, New Orleans. And at that moment, it caught me so off guard that I stopped. And I was like, I need to go read some reviews because I feel like I've missed something pretty major for this to like have caught me so off guard. So then I started doing some homework and then I came back to the book. So I still had that experience of, okay, I need something a little bit more. And actually, one of the reviews that I read, I think it was Matt Holder in Strange Horizons kind of talked about this, but how, you know, some fantasy novels will have kind of that appendix or that, you know, here's all the character names and here's all the terms and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I have such conflicted feelings about that because I did want it as a reader, but at the same time, I kind of respected that, like, he didn't do that because he is asking something of the reader. He's asking you to bring something to the table. And I think so much media in general really kind of spoon feeds us anymore and really like inadvertently talks down to us or condescend or I don't know. So I did like the decision not to do that and to just say, hey, this is the world I've created. You're welcome to come along. But, you know, again, I'm not going to spoon feed it to you.
Yeah. There is a glossary, Alex.
Oh,
it's completely unhelpful. It's more. I didn't find it until I got to the end of the book.
Oh my god!
I read it on Kindle, so I didn't. No. I just stopped at the end.
I don't think there was one in my hardcover copy.
Really?
No,
yeah,
I don't think so.
There's a glossary back here. It defines like maybe a fraction of the terms and ideas and concepts. There's also a map in the front of the book, which I found on my second try. I found the map to be really helpful just to like orient myself.
It's really fun, if nothing else.
It's a beautiful map. I'd love to see this in color.
I will show it to you. I think it's in two color, but it's really cool.
But yeah, if you want to look at the glossary, you're welcome to. It doesn't answer a lot.
Thank you. I'm going to do some homework during this recording session.
Yeah, Alex, I have to say, interestingly, that point with the two Caseys was also a point where I went, like, I didn't catch that. I didn't catch, it was all of a sudden like, wait a minute, Casey is working in a convenience store? No, that's not. And it was very confusing to me.
That was a different Casey.
Right, it was a different Casey.
Oh, no. Okay. I thought it was a different time.
No, that was NOLA Casey.
Oh, my gosh.
Right.
I just thought it was Casey from before he went to go work at the international school.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
No, that was happening concurrently.
Great. Good. Okay.
And that's what I love about this book.
Yeah. Okay. That makes a lot more sense.
Because I'm at it the same way Alex is, because I love those books. I love that completely immersive experience to just drop you in there. Now, to be fair, I felt like you were taking a shot at me because I have a chart and I have a glossary in the back of my book just because I know I'm asking a lot. But yeah, I imagine that it would not be real helpful with this book. In fact, it's funny because I do audiobooks. And so, like, I'm listening to the books and I'm just like, da, 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 da. And they're like, oh, yeah, two cases. Got it. Like, what just happened?
Yeah.
Right.
But there's no words in front of me to reorient myself. It's just, I could hit the rewind button or right. I'd be like, nope, I'm just along for the ride. Let's go. Let's just keep going. Yep. Hopefully I'll figure it out as I go. And I love that kind of reading experience. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's... But I did false start it a couple of times. And I do read fantasy and magical realism on the regular. And I was just like, wait a second. I can't remember how many chapters I got in. I was just like, did I miss something?
Yeah.
Let's start over again and go again. It didn't help. I was still aware of the exact same spot. But I'm like, all right, you know, I'm just going to push through.
Yeah. By the end of the book, I was like, because I kept doing that, too. I'd be like, I must have missed something here. Like, when did a zombie start speaking into a translator in the front of a dead tech?
You all have no idea how much better I feel hearing that everybody was in the same boat. I'm like, okay.
And I would flip back and be like, no, I didn't miss anything. This is just where we are.
Right.
This is the journey we're on.
Yeah. So at what point did you realize that Casey and Perry and Brendy and Peaches were in different worlds?
It really wasn't until the two Caseys came along, I don't think. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, which I came into this recording feeling like I'm going to feel like the stupidest one in the room because I was pretty sure I was just going to keep saying like I didn't realize it until way late in the book.
No.
For me, I mean, and I think it was partly because I stopped and doubled back and was like, I know I've missed something. I know... And it's tricky because magic exists in both worlds, but it exists in different ways. Mm-hmm. And in the world of the world that we live in, you know, NOLA is kind of a shorthand for New Orleans. So it didn't set off any like alarm bells that they're talking about it this way. I guess the downside of that experience with the book where they aren't kind of walking you along is that you do have that feeling of, okay, I've dropped the ball much more frequently, for better or worse. So, yeah, for me, I mean, it felt very late in the book. I don't know if that was where you were supposed to realize it or if I was just slow to catch on to something that had been established very clearly much earlier on.
Nothing was established very clearly.
I think that's right. Way. I mean, and again, that's either kind of one of the charms of the book or something that's so frustrating you have to stop reading it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's I actually teach a world building class. Mm. And there comes a point when you've done too much world building. Mm-hmm. And so there is that technique of like, I've created this, you know, fully immersive world. It's been fully thought out. It's fully, you know, alive. The only way for me for the reader to experience this is for me to just drop them in the middle of it, let them figure it out as they go. But there comes a point where it's, as a reader, you go, you know what? Is it worth this effort?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's been a couple of books where I've read that and I loved them up until that point. And I'm like, and now you've done one thing too many. Mm-hmm. I'm out.
Yeah.
This book comes close to that edge, but it never got me there. It's like, okay, we're coming close, but I'm still hanging on. I'm still hanging in there. And I think that's a credit to Alex, Alex Jennings. I mean,
you're great. Yeah, not to Alex.
I unfortunately cannot take any credit.
Right.
Alex has brought nothing to this discussion so far.
That's a credit to Jennings' ability to just have you barreling along just on the strength of his prose and the strength of his ideas. It's like, I'm still curious. I still want to see what you do next and what happens next.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things I love so much about this book is that I truly cannot remember the last time I read a book that was this inventive and this original and just felt so playful and so generous with its creativity. And I mean, there were times when I was like, okay, you don't have to be that generous because I'm losing the thread. But at the same time, it's hard to fault a writer for saying, you know what, I'm going to put everything I've got into this book. I'm not going to like save it for a sequel or, you know, and I did enjoy it. So I kind of had that same feeling where, you know, we'd creep up right up to that edge. I think the edge for me at one point was where they go into kind of the underwater world. And I was like, this seems like a whole, like the rules here are even different from the other.
But at to cut.
The underwater bar had me in tears. That whole scene, I thought it was hilarious.
Well, then it won me back over. Yeah.
It became so bizarre that I was like, you know what? I'm here for it.
Right.
The only thing for me that tipped it over the edge, I loved the world building. For me, the world building never went over the deep end, literally, even when we were underwater. But the number of characters for me became confusing. I feel like at a certain point, I was like, did we need Mama Lisa? And like, it just went at a certain point. I was like, okay, who is everyone? Now we've got double Casey's. We had double Brindy's for a while.
We have double Daddy Deeks.
Just doubles. And then I had a sense that like characters in the beginning that I thought would be really, really like important and critical to the plot. By the end, I forgot Jailbird existed at one point.
Yeah.
And the lady that was like walking around wearing all red, I was like, oh, she's probably a really important song. Mm-hmm. And then she never came back up again. And I mean, maybe she did, but it was a lot of characters.
I think that might have been Tipsy Tina.
Was that? Oh, and then she died in the club.
Yeah. It was either Tipsy Tina or...
I think
what's
it was
the other one? Walk Down Blues. That was the first one that Perry saw. Walk Down Blues, and I think Walk Down Blues got killed by Stagger Lee.
That's what I'm thinking of.
Okay.
I also, to answer your question, Ken, I had a suspicion we were operating in two different dimensions. I was trying to find it, but I couldn't. That scene in the car yard where the reality sort of overlapped, and that guy was very innocently just trying to do his job. And then he's like coming into contact with magic, and it's like, what? And then he almost got taken along in the sack, didn't he?
Yeah, and he's also got a robot.
He also had a robot.
Which opens so many more questions. Yeah. There are sentient robots in this universe.
Yeah,
or maybe it's in like a slightly side universe. And that was another piece
of it. Wait, was that? Which world
could
was
it
that?
Be? Because, you know, at one point they sort of describe the structure of reality as being like a honeycomb. Like there are these universes and different structures. Mm-hmm. So I thought, oh my God, it might not be two worlds. We might be dealing with this massive structure that I'm not even seeing yet. So I don't know if the junkyard.
It reminded me of the way the universes in the movie Us are handled, where they are happening at the same time, but one is like a tether to the other. That's sort of how I was thinking.
So this is what Dr. John says. Dr. John has that little conversation with Casey. Casey Revel.
Not Revel.
Revel. I thought he said it was Revel.
And one was Ravel.
No. One was Bridgewater.
Oh, that's right.
I remember Casey Bridgewater. I remember Casey Ravel.
I think it's Ravel. I think he pronounced
Casey,
it Ravel. Trismegistus.
Yeah. I don't remember Ravel, but I'm not saying that.
No, it's Ravel. It's Ravel.
Oh, there's right. Okay. Yeah. I thought maybe they were
so
like
not
two.
No.
Casey R.
He was the one who met Dr. John.
I feel like we need an official ruling.
Right. So Dr. John said, and again, the lovely prose here, Maurice. Dr. John says, now, the scripturists tend to simplificate things so the common mind has a chance of accepting the ideas they relate. It ain't just heaven on the one side and hell on the other. There's worlds upon worlds upon worlds on this side, that side, and everywhere in between. So that's how Dr. John, who said he was one of the creators of this world, described those relationships.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So one of the inciting incidents was that, as Professor Longhair said, some of his songs got stole. But do we ever learn how the songs got away?
Did one of the songs become sentient? So I think it was Peaches. Peaches is a song, right?
Well, what a good question. What a good question. Shall we go there? Is Peaches a song?
I think one of the songs let everyone else out.
So I guess on the timeline, I wasn't totally sure. In my reading, the breach happened when Jaylen broke through, when the building explosion, which I'm not sure when that happened in the timeline that Perry and Brendy and Peaches are living in. So I don't know if I know sequentially in the novel, the explosion happens after we've kind of been introduced to the idea that the songs have been stolen. But I guess in my head, I had turned that into kind of the inciting incident. But I could be totally wrong. But that seemed to me like the breach between worlds that would have allowed someone to steal the songs or to move them between dimensions.
Yeah, maybe that's true. I guess what I guess I'm saying, the inciting incident in Nola, anyway, or for Perry and Brendy and Peaches' story, was the songs got stolen. But do we know they got stolen? I mean, and if they were stolen, why was Staggerly hunting them? Why was Lafcadio O'Hearn? And what a weird character to choose as a villain. But Lafcadio O'Hearn, do you all know who Lafcadio O'Hearn was or what he did? Or?
See, this is what I mean. This book brings with it homework assignments.
It really does.
Because I started looking up everybody. I looked up him. I looked up Staggerly. I looked up Yakima.
These are real people?
Well, Lafcadio O'Hearn was
Right. Christine, I didn't know that either.
I'm questioning my own existence.
Lafcadio O'Hearn was a writer. Mm-hmm. He had a weird childhood, lost his left eye in a playground accident when he was 13 years old, worked for a newspaper in Cincinnati, married a black woman. That was a no-no back in the mid-1800s. He fled to New Orleans. And was kind of worked for a newspaper in New Orleans and was kind of a storyteller in New Orleans. And in fact, such a great quote that I'll dig it up, that he said something about, he loved New Orleans, but he also recognized the decay of it. And it was, gosh, I'll have to find it. A dead bride crowned with orange flowers. And if you think in the book, there were these orange tentacles that came down from Yakuma.
Yeah.
Well, Yakuma was what he became after he moved to Japan and married a Japanese woman. And he not only kind of introduced New Orleans culture to the rest of America, he introduced Japanese culture to the West.
Huh.
So that was Lafcadio O'Hearn, and he is like maybe the antagonist of the book.
So, okay, I'm just going to just ask a stupid question because I did not do my homework. I didn't realize it was a real historical figure. So are you saying that the real historical Lafcadio O'Hearn changed his name and moved to Japan?
Yes.
Okay, well, never
what
mind. That changes
to his
my
first wife.
So I thought Lafcadio O'Hearn in the book was just a disguise that this evil spirit had kind of assumed.
Yeah.
I didn't realize there was like they were historically these are actually the same person.
No.
That's why we're using these.
That blew me away the first time. And the only reason I knew about Lafcadio O'Hearn was because like years and years ago a friend mentioned Lafcadio O'Hearn to me and I went, Lafcadio O'Hearn? That's the weirdest name I've ever heard.
So weird.
Yeah. So I've really like known about him for a long time, and that really kind of it was such a weird character to have be the evil guy. But was he the antagonist, or was the storm the antagonist?
Or was it Stagger Lee?
He was certainly a bad guy.
He was. I mean,
was he?
Not really.
Well,
he said he was awful, and then Brendy told him one joke, and he was like, oh, never mind.
But he still seems like Perry kind of sent him to hell by the end of the book.
Yeah.
I kind of saw, like, there's a lot of comic book references in this book. And I kind of saw, like, a Fantastic Four structure to the end of the novel where you have, like, the Galactus, this elemental force in the storm who also has these avatars. And Stagger Lee was kind of the Silver Surfer role. The Herald who's doing this nefarious deed. And then he, like, switches sides. I don't know. But then I thought the trumpet could be like the ultimate nullifier a little bit, which I don't know.
Well, I think Jenny's...
I wouldn't like jump to those conclusions, but the comic book references come so frequently in this book. I'm like,
Jennings wanted it to be a comic book, I think. At the end of this, at least, there's a little bit of an author interview, and he said he wanted it to be a comic book at first. I mean, I think so. It was It's been a, I think I read it last week. But yeah, he was like, I wanted this format to first be a comic book.
So, Christine, let's, or Alex, I forget who mentioned it. Christine, I think you did. Is Peaches a song? And is Perry a song?
Yeah. I feel like everyone was a song. I feel like everyone in NOLA was a song.
Maybe
some songs are more important than others. Like maybe the classics are like powering NOLA. Like Peaches was probably a classic, and probably Peaches' father, who like threw her off of that ship, which I'm still coming to terms with that whole situation. Uh-huh. But I thought Peaches was a song. I think, I don't know that Perry was a song, just because of his, like, how much he struggled to, like, play music slash, like, be a magician, I guess. Not be a magician, but, like, to do magic via music. So I'm not sure that he was a song, but I think Peaches was.
Yeah, I was pretty sure Peaches was, because I think one of the characters even describes her as, hang on, I wrote it down, a tuneless little ditty at the intersection of forgetting and remembrance.
Yeah, that was our pal Lafcadio.
Ah, there we go.
Yeah, he was informing her. It was like one of those speeches that the villain gives to James Bond before he kills him. He just could go, just shoot him.
And she, like, trusted him, too. She called him, it was Mr. Larry, wasn't it?
Mr. Larry,
yeah. She trusted him.
Yeah. Yeah. Weird. But Perry, what do you think? I mean, the book is The Ballad of Perry Graves, right?
Oh, yeah. Got us there.
Right.
It is.
Yeah.
Well, maybe the whole book was a song.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's possible that everyone in NOLA was a song.
I think it's possible.
But, I mean...
I think you could make that argument. Wasn't sure how to take the ending where Perry is sort of in this kind of in-between world where he's not like among the living necessarily, but he's definitely not dead, because I'm pretty sure they explicitly reference that, like, he could still die or eventually will die, you know, versus the storm, which is this eternal antagonist. So, I mean, he's something other than your standard issue human, but
he might be dead, but
he might.
I think they're all dead. Like,
I think all the people. Well,
you're not even trying it anymore.
The lost ending.
Like, and the thing is, like, even like when Staggerly was like shooting the zombies, I was like, aren't they already dead? I don't understand. Like, can you be more dead?
Apparently.
there are different levels of death. I mean, it comes back to the superhero thing. Because even then, I'm just
dead.
At worst case scenario, this was a superhero death.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, kind of dead.
True. Yeah,
but,
yeah.
I mean, I sat through Wakanda Forever going, you know, I could bring back T'Challa in about 30 minutes.
Right? It would take me
I've already figured out how I could do that.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you've read all the Dune books, Duncan Idaho comes back hundreds and hundreds of years later. That's the point where I said, okay, I'm out of Dune books.
Yeah, I don't know. Even the people, like, quote unquote, living in New Orleans, the world, not NOLA, I had my doubts about them, too. Like, I'm like, what if everyone died in Katrina? Like, even Casey, Bridgewater, that's the one. That's the...
No, that's Casey...
Who's the one...
Casey Ravel is the New Orleans Casey.
Oh.
Casey Bridgewater is the NOLA Casey.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, well, I thought Casey New Orleans was maybe even dead until their worlds collided. And then I was like, well, maybe not.
Yeah, it's interesting. It was interesting to me that in New Orleans, Casey was a trans man, and in NOLA, he was not.
Mm-hmm.
He was a man.
Yeah.
I just want to remind everyone we're talking about the book The Ballad of Perilous Graves by Alex Jennings, and wow, what a book. there's so much crazy stuff in the book. What were your favorite crazy elements?
I am a sucker for those comic book references.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of what I think added to that, this whole idea of all the layers that go on in this book, like the real figures that get incorporated into the story. The comic book references made it a thing that was living to me. And because my favorite one, hang on, there was a reference. So, and I think this was Casey talking, but like more like something Richard Case would have designed for Grant Morrison's run on Doom Patrol, but with the suggestion of Manola's Deep Shadows. And I'm like, yeah, that perfectly works for me. I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah. Because I had that same thought.
You may as well have been talking Chinese to
right,
me.
Right. Yeah,
my eyes glazed over.
Right, now. Right. And I'm like, yeah, because Morrison, that was a classic run on Doom Patrol. Of course that would be it. So I'm like, I'm ready to pull up a chair and like, I need to have coffee with Alex Jennings and or you. I'm not good with the Alexes. But I'm like, ready to pull up. I'm like, this is some next level nerd stuff. That yeah, I'm like, this was like a line written for like us.
Yeah.
This is us.
Yeah, it wasn't just like a reference for the sake of getting like the reference points or something. It was like no, you're gonna have to know what I'm talking about to know what I'm right. talking about, which yeah. I liked a lot. One of the things that stood out as a favorite moment, which there's so much in this book that we haven't even talked about so Casey creates these characters that kind of take on lives of their own.
Yeah.
And one
B
of them,
B Sharp.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to say B Swarm. But there's this moment that Casey has with B Sharp where they're talking and B Sharp kind of asks like, am I enough for you? Am I what you need me to be? And it was just such like a touching, beautiful moment, mm-hmm. just completely unexpected. And then the rest of the book, I was like, well, this needs more Casey. Where's Casey? Every time it would cut to the kid, because it was just like, it just, for me, it was just such a surprisingly touching moment between this character and something he had created. And it felt very human to me. And it mm-hmm. added a depth that sometimes in books with a lot of action, and there are some like real slugfest moments in this book, you don't get as much of, I guess, kind of the emotional resonance. And, mm-hmm. and for whatever reason, that moment just really stood out to me as like, it just kind of gave me a pause and made me appreciate some of the emotional depth of that character. And then, like I said, then I just wanted more Casey for the rest of the book. I even, since I did read it on a Kindle, I was able to like go back and search for Casey references, because I was convinced by the end that like Casey had just been dropped. Like, it's like, I don't feel like we've seen much of Casey lately.
Yeah.
And then, but when I was flipping through, I was like, no, he's been in it very steadily. Like it wasn't like, you know, we go the last half of the book with no Casey until the very end. So I don't know if that was just me wanting more of that character or what, but yeah, I think that was the moment in particular that kind of sealed Casey as for me, one of the most interesting characters.
Yeah. I really liked the moments of this book that provided like some, not comedic relief, because I found the whole book to be pretty comedic, but just moments where it was like I was getting frustrated and thinking like, okay, which realm of existence am I currently in?
Yeah.
And then something would happen, like the dead taxi ride where the zombie was like like screaming into the microphone and the translation was like, you have arrived. I was like in tears.
That was my favorite, like one of my favorite things in the whole book.
So funny.
Was the zombie translator.
He was so polite. Yeah. And then Peaches paid him in hell notes, whatever those are. And it was like 50,000 hell notes. And I was like, how does their economy work? And then the underground bar, that whole scene with that Nutria bartender was really funny. And I really liked the Peabodys as well. I thought that was really interesting. And the whole thing about the floating graffiti and the graffiti tags, I thought it was beautiful. I loved the idea of like, I mean, I know the Peabodys are problematic being that you know, they're addicts, which is a bummer, but I really liked the Peabodys and the tree that was like drunk and told Brindy what to do. And like, I don't know, there were just so many little moments where I was like, whenever I would get frustrated or think like, I can't make heads or tails of this book. And I'm like, oh, I'm not supposed to. There's a zombie driving a taxi.
Exactly.
It's not supposed to make sense. But yeah, I liked those elements.
Oh my gosh, Christine, you just took everything I had written down.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I also love just the Nutria, the thing when Casey Ravel first cross over into NOLA, and the first thing he sees is, oh my lord, a Nutria in a three-piece suit walking down the street. A huge Nutria in a three-piece suit. That was
I want this to be, I think it'd be a great movie or a miniseries. I feel like it would be easier to follow in movie format than in book, which I don't often feel like is the case.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's in terms of miniseries, not movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Movie. It would be a long than, movie.
Yeah, miniseries. I was actually thinking, and now you got me locked into thinking about this in terms of comic books. But it's like, I felt like, what if you had taken like the first half of like Neil Gaiman's Sandman run and tried to make just a single standalone novel out of it? That's the feeling I have with this book. There's so much jammed in it, mm-hmm. so much world, so much, and so many threads. I keep coming back to this whole idea of threads. Because, you know, when you're writing, you know, you leave these little threads because you never know what's going to be useful to you later on, which you may come back and revisit, you know, and I'm just like, there are so many just threads mm-hmm. in this whole thing, which you would think, well, you know, now if it's a standalone, well, in the editing process, I'll just get rid of all those threads. But like, no, I'm going to leave them.
Yeah.
Because, well, A, he could come back and do another book in the series, or I just like the messiness of it, frankly. Yeah. I think the messiness of it actually adds to the book. Like, hey, what does that mean? I don't know.
Like, a thread I wanted to pull so bad was when Mama Lisa came back from the dead, or not dead, I don't know, came out of disappearance, and there was this whole saga about, like, Mama Lisa and Yvette and the wise women and the history of this pebble that Brindy inherited. And I was like, this is a whole book. Mm-hmm. I thought it was so fascinating. Yeah. And the way that time passed in NOLA was different than New Orleans, from what I understand. Like, Brindy was becoming an adult mm-hmm. as a child, and she encountered that kid who appeared to be like 5 years old, but he was like driving a car. And she was like, how old are you? And he was like, I don't know. And right. like, I
well, there's think no the, such thing as grown-ups. There are only right. kids,
old right. kids pretending. Yeah. But there was like I think the first time Perry uses magic and winds up somewhere, which is the best way I can describe it. Someone says, do you remember where you came from? Like, how mm-hmm. long has it been? And I was like, that's a whole thread. Like, mm-hmm. the way that time passes, I have so many questions.
Right.
Like, how much time passed in this book, do we think? Mm. Was it
Hard
a day
to tell,
or was
right.
it 10 years? Yeah. I genuinely don't know. It could have been 20 minutes or 20 years. Like,
so was the... Something we haven't talked about is the Clackensack. Mm. Is the Clackensack just a gateway between the worlds? When they jumped into the Clackensack, did they go to New Orleans? Do we know that? Clickety clack.
Oh, don't look at me, Maurice. Everybody turned this way, and I'm like,
because you have the clipboard,
right.
So we figure
that makes it
official. Right,
yeah,
right,
what
right,
is the clipboard?
Right, clickety clack. Maurice brought us get out of the sack.
Right. And you know, and I'm such a nerd. It's the first time he was introduced, I'm like, oh, he has a bag of holding, and I just kept on moving at that point.
I didn't know that until they realized they were stuck in the sack. I just thought it was like a potato sack. Until he realized they were stuck in there. And then right, I was like, oh, it's like a portal. Or
well,
like,
but they were in other places when they were in the sack.
Well, I mean,
they were in a bunch of
different.
They weren't just like in the dark.
They did get stuck in there the first time, though.
Yeah.
And then I realized, like, oh, I thought of it as like the loading screen in the movie The Matrix, where you have to like load your program. That's the way that I thought of it. But
apparently,
we can't
do this show without mentioning The Matrix. Okay.
Have I mentioned it every
no,
time?
No, Steve Woods has mentioned it every time.
Okay, I think I have too. but I did not, Maurice. I did when that sack was brought out. My brain did not go to holding sack. I was like, okay, is he going to put things in it? Like I didn't get it at all.
So where do they travel? Because I remember the first time they're in it, and it seems like they're in this kind of like null space. Like they're safe mm-hmm. from, because I think they were being attacked when they first go in it, and then they kind of don't really know where they are.
But then they were also in other places. Like weren't they in church and part of it? And
yeah, well, that's he went
they
through. Like,
so they
yeah.
Okay.
yeah.
So
I mean,
they
it took
around.
A while before Perry realized what the issue was, and he said, "Get out of my sack."
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah,
so
I don't
could
know.
There be places that other people had put in the sack?
Those like, other
could someone have
maybe
put a church in the sack, and yeah. now it's just kind of.
But
in...
who put it? Like, who had it before him?
I don't know. We don't know.
I don't know. One of the wise women, maybe.
I thought the wise woman just had the pebble.
Well, but
you know,
but,
I'm thinking the person listening to this podcast right now.
Right, they've turned it off.
What is going on with this book?
You're like, what did they take before they started talking?
Well, no, that's what we. I mean, that's why I put that note up at the front to say if you haven't read the book, you might just not want to listen to this. Not just because of the spoilers.
Read the book, you might still. Yeah.
Yeah. So, what do we think about the ending? What happened? What happened?
What happened?
Yeah. What happened to cause the ending to be what it was? And can someone describe that?
Well, I mean, so Perry has the trumpet, which
is... The Elysian trumpet.
Yeah.
And the mouthpiece.
And the mouthpiece,
which allows him to kind of play the music. He's still struggling a little bit, but it seems like everybody kind of comes around him and, you know, lays hands on him almost to help him be able to do what he needs to do to defeat the storm. I mean, right, he's battling the storm, because at the end it describes him playing into the eye of the storm. Mm-hmm. And if it sounds like I'm trying to coach myself along, I am a little bit, because I'm trying to remember exactly how this happened. And then it kind of, you get to that kind of climax where it cuts from him, and then I think we go back to Casey. So, I mean, Casey's back in the real world. His cousin's alive again. So we get the sense that something's been restored. Mm-hmm. And then we go back to Perry, and he's no longer really in NOLA. He's kind of in, you know, like I said, kind of this afterlife. But based on another character he's talking to who says, you know, we will all die eventually. He's not dead. He may be song dead, you know, but so I don't know. I don't think I'm answering your question. I'm really just kind of rehashing the end, because I
struggled with the ending. I read it twice and again last night too, because I finished it last week before I was sick. And like, I even read the end again last night and I was like, whoa. It's a climax in the way that I think every character and thread mentioned sort of comes to a point. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is a lot. This ending could have been a whole book.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't mean to talk so much. I think the important thing is Perry plays the music and it knits the two worlds back together. That's really, suddenly everything's back together. In some cases, there are even two versions of buildings and places, because even though they've been knit back together, things aren't back the way they were. You just have this new synthesis. So I think from that, you know, there's enough evidence that Perry's been successful in preventing the storm from destroying either NOLA or New Orleans. But the threat is still, you know, this is a reprieve. This isn't, you know, an ultimate victory.
Is there any suggestion that this was all a dream? The last line of the book is, and then he opened his eyes.
I thought he was opening his eyes to, like, a NOLA that we hadn't even seen yet. Like, in addition to repairing and sort of knitting together these worlds, I feel like he unlocked a new dimension, because there weren't already enough. That's what I took it as. Like, he's now entered the next level of NOLA 2.0. I didn't get the sense that it was a dream, though.
Anybody else have a comment on the ending? Well, if not, what do you think? Would you all recommend this book to other normal readers? Christine?
I would not recommend this book to anyone. No. That's not how I meant it. I would recommend it to some people, but not to just anyone on the street.
Oh, I see. Yeah, okay.
I would recommend this book to a select few, but not just to, like, any old person. I think I would recommend it to someone who loves music, I think, is probably the first thing that drew me into this book was the love of music and just the feeling of music. I listened to a lot of Ornette Coleman while I was reading this. There's also, I think there's a Spotify playlist that's paired with this book that I haven't listened to yet. So I'd recommend it to someone who loves music. I don't know that I'd recommend it to just any reader who... I think it's a big barrier to overcome for any reader. But for someone who loves music, or for someone who's like Alex and Maurice, then yes, I would absolutely recommend it. It's a wild ride. I'd also recommend it to someone who didn't love Harry Potter. There are moments in this book where it reminded me of Harry Potter, but more grown up and with so much more soul and so much more heart and mystery. So I might even recommend it to someone who grew up on Harry Potter, but who wants something a lot more mature and more difficult.
Mm, great, great. Alex, it has been officially recommended to you.
You should read this book, Alex.
I, in turn, will recommend it to Maurice. And I would recommend it. Christine makes a pretty fair point that there are definitely people I probably wouldn't say it would be the right book for, but that's, true of any book. This is an especially challenging book in some ways, and I think if you like that, and if you like that kind of crazy unleashed imagination that just seems to be, like, barely under control at all times in service of the story, you'll really enjoy this. So I would recommend it. But I do think it takes a certain willingness to just feel like you are trying to play catch up. Like, I think if you can be comfortable with that feeling while you're reading a book, then you'll really enjoy it.
Yeah. Maurice, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I'd recommend it since I recommended it for now. I think one of the things I've been thinking about a lot about it, I mean, the comic book thing has really been like, oh man, comic books have the Neil Gaiman, thinking about it in terms of like Neil Gaiman's Sandman, you try to condense that down and, right, and very much would probably feel a lot like this. And actually, I was thinking about the show, what was it, Once Upon a Time, that or Grimm, whichever one, is all about like fairy tales, right? And so when I think about this book, I'm thinking about, yeah, we are lost in this field of like stories and folklore and myth making with a lexicon that we are just unfamiliar with. We've been dropped in the middle of that. And our job as readers is to explore this universe and explore this world. And I absolutely love that. And so, yeah, I would recommend this book.
Yeah, I think I would agree with Christine. I have a number of people for whom I would recommend this book and a number of people who I would suggest go running from it.
Yeah, put it down.
Yeah, they just won't have a good time with it. I had a great time with it. I had a great time with it a couple times through.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure I would recommend it to everyone. But in general, yeah, I would.
Of course, the bulk of my friend circle looks a lot like this. Yeah. So I'm like, oh, I recommend it to everybody. Yeah. All my friends are like nerds. So,
Yeah. Well, there you go. Well, so let's talk about some recommendations. Anyone have a recommendation for the good of the cause? Christine?
Yeah. So the book that I actually recommend, and I thought of this book a couple times while I was reading, and I think I just settled on it now based on this conversation. It's an old book. It's a classic. I'd recommend Kindred by Octavia Butler. Hmm. It is like this. It's like she is dropped in this world that is completely foreign to her. Hmm. And it's sort of up to her to get out and to make sense of it. I haven't read it in like 10 or 15 years, but it is a classic in terms of African-American literature. And I feel like this book probably will be too. Mm-hmm. And I think that was one of Octavia Butler's earlier works was Kindred, which is a fascinating like debut or even a second book. So I think that would be my recommendation.
Yeah,
for any reader, I think Kendrick is good.
Yeah.
Kendrick.
Yeah, great recommendation.
Kendrick.
Yeah, Kendrick is good too.
Kendrick Lamar, yeah, he's great.
Yeah, thanks, Christine. Yeah. Alex.
Yeah, so actually, it's funny, Maurice, that you keep bringing up Neil Gaiman, because my recommendation was going to be Neverwhere, which is another novel that kind of plays with a fantasy city overlaid on an existing city where there is some symbiotic relationship between the two, where the fantasy version of the city plays with history and real places and people and also completely makes interesting things up. So if you like books that play with place in that way as kind of your fantasy setting as an alternate version of a real city, then I think you might like Neverwhere.
Yeah, awesome. Great recommendation. Maurice?
Well, if you guys still trust me after this one.
Absolutely. Even more.
Right. I'm going to go with The Lies of Ajungo. Did it just come out? I think it just came out maybe a few weeks ago, by Moses Utomi. It's a fantasy novel, a more straightforward fantasy novel. It's about a young boy who is trying to save the life of his mother, and he makes a deal with the king. The king says, I'll save your life of the mother, but you have to go and go fetch water for our village to survive. So he then has to go fetch this water, in this world known as the Forever Desert.
Oh.
Thanks.
And then hijinks ensue.
Yeah.
Wow. That sounds great. What's that called again, Maurice?
The Lies of a Jungo.
Awesome. So I decided I was going to recommend the only fantasy novel I could think of that sort of got close to as crazy as this one. And it's probably my favorite fantasy novel. It's John Crowley's Little Big. It won the World Fantasy Award in 1982, and it would take about an hour to summarize. But it's a multi-generational saga about the Drinkwater family, house designed by the architect John Drinkwater, the house sits like on the edge of another world that's a fairy world. It's hard to get to. You can't really get to the house. There's also a president of the United States who's the reincarnation of the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick Barbarossa, who's like plunging the nation into civil war, which also has something to do with the fairies. And that just really scratches the surface of the novel and doesn't do it justice. Crowley's just a beautiful writer. And I love Little Big almost as much as I love Engine Summer.
I was going to say,
which might be my favorite book, period. Mm-hmm. So, well, that's it for this episode. You can find notes for this and all of our shows in the Radio Free Book Club blog on medium.com. You can also follow us and drop us a note on Facebook, stream the show wherever you listen to podcasts. Our show is produced by the original Oreo Jones for 99.1 WQRTLP in Indianapolis. For Maurice Broaddus, Christine Hudson, Alex Mattingly, and all the members of Radio Free Book Club, I'm Ken Honeywell. Thanks for listening, and join us next month when we'll be discussing Hernan Diaz's 2002 novel Trust and all the things that title implies. Until then, read a book.